You're tuned to KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. My name is Mark Hart. This is Heart to Heart Talk. Today on Pearl Harbor Day, December 7th, we are going to discuss, we're going to have a wide-ranging political discussion, but we're going to start out with, of course, the thing that's on everyone's mind, and that's the war in Iraq and the war on terror. And then we'll kind of move from there. Without any further ado, I'm going to bring on my guest, and we're going to introduce him. Jay, you there?
Yes, I am.
Go ahead and introduce yourself to Orange County and hopefully the world on the World Wide Web, and tell us what you do, and tell us about a little bit about yourself.
My name is Jay Leggett. I'm a writer and an actor in Hollywood, one of those Hollywood elites, Mark. And I'm basically, I guess, someone who's in opposition to the war, and to the, not to the war on terror, but certainly into some of the way the war has been handled. And I've been, I studied history and been in show business ever since, but also was a, grew up in the Midwest and moved out to the West Coast. I've traveled around a lot and lived in a lot of places. So just sort of a regular good American like yourself. And I wanted to come on when I first talked to you, and we kind of cross swords about all this stuff.
Okay, tell us a little bit about your credits. You've produced some movies, and you've been on some TV shows as well. Tell us about
that.
I have.
I was on the original. I was in the cast show in Living Color. I was a writer, and I was in the cast. I was that's when I first came to LA. I've written and produced the Employee of the Month, which is a movie that was a Sundance film a couple years ago with Matt Dillon and Christina Applegate. My last movie was Without a Paddle, which I wrote with my same guy I produced the Employee of the Month with, Without a Paddle, came out last summer, and we're working on a new feature for Fox right now. And I've done probably another, without getting into my whole resume, a lot of other television guest star stuff, NYPD Blue and, ER and lots of other things of that nature. So I've been out here for about 10 years doing that as a regular profession.
Excellent. And if you go to the KUCI Talk website, there is a link to a short biography and some of your credits.
All right.
Okay, again, we're on KUCI 80.9 FM in Irvine. The views expressed in the show are not the views of KUCI, the University of California at Irvine, the UC Board of Regents, the governor, or really anybody else but myself and Mr. Leggett. Okay, let's start off. This morning, I happened to catch on NPR most of Mr. Bush's speech this morning, and it was not done at a naval base or at an army base. It was done at the Council of Foreign Relations, which is quite liberal, very liberal, actually, the CFR. So that was an interesting change. Now, there had been some calls that he give speeches on universities and some other places besides military bases, so he did that. And from what I caught, I'm going to go ahead and try to relay what he said, and you comment on it. Here's what I took away from what I heard this morning, and that is that if we cut and run, if we pull out before all our goals are completed, it will send the wrong message for really centuries to all our enemies and actually open the door for enemies. And the one thing that Mr. Bush quoted this morning is he quoted some they intercepted some documents and some communiques between various al-Qaeda people, and they kept quoting over and over again the Vietnam War, the Somalian adventure in the early 90s, as well as Mr. Reagan's pullout from Lebanon as proof that we're weak and we can be had. And I agree with him. Whether we got duped into this war, whether we got lied to or whatever, right now, where we stand, we have to stick it out, because if we don't, we're going to invite every tin pot, you know, tyrant from here for the next 300 years to attack us. What do you say about that comment?
Well, I mean, I'm confused by that comment, to tell you the truth, Mark. I think that's Mr. Bush. As much as I'd love to give him the benefit of the doubt, number one, for him to quote any intelligence to us now at this point and expect us to believe it on its face, to me, is laughable. I mean, this has been a president who's presided over the biggest intelligence blunders, and in fact, I mean, that is giving him the benefit of the doubt. Moreover, I would say he's, frankly, found the intelligence that he's wanted to tell us, told us the tiny bit of it, sent Colin Powell into the front of the UN and made him into a liar. And so for him to quote intelligence about anecdotal evidence of someone quoting things about Vietnam and expecting us to think that that's a basis for anything is laughable. Secondly, on the historical merits, I disagree as well. Had we pulled out of Vietnam, we'd have been better off. There's no question in my mind. That was another era of, although a lot of the links to some of the same guys advising Mr. Bush are guys from that era, under which we were supposed to believe that the domino theory was going to take over that the communists would take over the earth if we didn't lose all these people in Vietnam. We should have pulled out of Vietnam. Kennedy should have got us out of Vietnam. Johnson could have. None of them did it. And Bush is the same way. Now, I will say this. I'm not somebody that says we should just take tomorrow, pull every single troop out of there. We did get in there under whatever pretenses, and I'm not someone who says let's get everybody out tomorrow. But in terms of a withdrawal or what the mess we're going to send to these people, I think that's silly. I mean, I don't think there's any way to know it to sound like Donald Rumsfeld. So I disagree that on both a historical basis, and I really am skeptical of any intelligence quotes that this administration gives us, and I think anyone has a right to be.
Well, you certainly have a right to not trust Mr. Bush, and I don't trust him in a lot of cases. But as a general historical principle, and I know that at one time you had wanted to be a history major, but I actually...
I was indeed and have a degree in it.
Okay, excellent. Okay, my bad on that. I'm actually reading now the history of England, and I'm on the early parts. I'm up to the 12s. And over, what I found is that if a king showed any weakness at all, somebody would attack, whether it's the Angles, the Saxons, the Normans, whatever. So, you know, we're not dealing with enlightened people. We're not dealing with decent people. We're dealing with, in many cases, they're animals. So you have to be strong, and if we pull out and if we don't complete the job, it's just going to hurt us down the road. Whether we got lied to or not, the bottom line is we're in this position. So that's how I feel about it.
Mark, I think that one of the things you're missing there is, I just think misapplying, and it's interesting to me, whether the listeners would know it. We've certainly discussed this at some length before, but there's a fascinating thing that goes on, I think, with every new era of politics, and in this case, conflict, to me, and that is the danger that you fight the last war. And I think one of the things you're talking about, and in fact, the analogy you're using is an analogy of not only the last war, but using this sort of empirical or empire-based thinking where we're going to somehow, to show weakness, a king is going to be attacked. I think that's it's a completely different world, and I know you know that, but I think that's really something that's happening at the national level where they're treating this as if, their rhetoric is often leaning towards this. These are the Nazis, that they have 20 tank divisions and or whatever it might be. But I think this business of showing any weakness and the fact that pulling out of a situation which is ultimately, in my mind, going to turn into a big civil war anyway, is going to somehow show us to be weak is ridiculous. I mean, frankly, the rest of the world, their opinion should matter too. You're basing everything on what are these terrorists going to think or what is some, I don't know, an unnamed enemy going to think of us, when in fact the rest of the world has turned completely against us in terms of our judgment, what they think of our judgment, and everything else because of what we've done. I think pulling out of there judiciously would make the rest of the world and our traditional allies happy and make us stronger on that basis across the board. So I agree. I disagree with that entirely.
Well, yeah, certainly there's a couple of issues there, but the one point that I was latching on to was not some sort of strategy or time-based issue, but just an understanding of human nature, and that some people are the only thing they have left about their humanity is the basis form. And so what I'm looking at is that when you're dealing with a dog or an animal or whatever, you have got to be strong. So it's not any strategy, whether it's 1910, 2005, or 40,000 BC. It's the same thing. If you show weakness and if you pull out, they're going to jump on it. And I believe the intelligence, Al Qaeda, is still citing Vietnam and Lebanon and Somalia. And
so you think we should have stayed in Somalia?
We can't give them another one. You know what?
You were one of the Republicans criticizing us for sending troops on the soil in the first place, because I can give you 100 quotes of that. This reversal of these Republicans is unbelievable, and I'd like to hear your answer to that. You wanted us to go into Somalia, and you wanted us to stay. Is that what you're saying?
Well, it's unfortunately the nasty side of politics, and whoever's out of power will attack whoever's in power, and they're switching sides all over the place.
But I'm talking about, let's throw that out the window. Do you think we should have stayed in Somalia?
You know, I think we could have done a better job and not turn-tailed just like that. I think we could have, you know, we could have done a little better job. I don't know what that would have been, but, you know, just turning tail after, you know, what was it, 19 soldiers or something getting killed and a couple Blackhawks down, that seemed a little ridiculous to me.
Okay. Well, I mean, I would love to ask the administration that question, because, I mean, there was nothing but criticism for even going in there. And, you know, it's the same, and as a sidebar to that, it's the same sort of selective military application, selective worldview that says that's what's happening with Saddam Hussein in this country in the first place, Mark. I mean, I know I don't want to go back and go through every what could have happened or should have happened with the intelligence, but, you know, the fact that I listen to a lot of the right-wing radio stuff and the pundits on television, and one of the talking points that just drives me crazy is Hussein committed these atrocities. I mean, there's countries all over the world right now that are doing that, and they are absolutely against us going into Darfur, I'm sure. George Bush, this president, ran on not being a nation builder. And then all of a sudden, after 9/11, he's mad about the crimes that Hussein committed 25 years ago. And that's what he's on trial for. That's what Hussein's on trial for. That just blows my mind. Anyway, I think it's the same kind of thing that there's not one sort of status quo, and I don't think it's just politics. I think a lot of it's because they're in a bad situation. They've got to get themselves out, and they're reversing their opinions on everything to make themselves look good. So,
well, you know, the one good thing, another good thing I can take away from Mr. Bush's stance is that he seems to be, at least in my opinion, basically not paying attention to politics. Now, maybe that'll change, but
you know, the politics?
Well, the political thing to do would be to pull out, because Republicans are going to get destroyed in the next congressional election if they don't.
He had a university professor in public relations write his last speech. You don't think he's paying attention to politics? This is the guy who always says, I don't believe in polls. Had literally a pollster from Duke write his last speech, a public opinion war pollster.
No,
and you don't think he's paying attention to politics?
On this issue, it seems to me that Mr. Bush is willing to sacrifice many Republican congressional seats in order to finish what he started. And in a sense, he doesn't really care because, you know, he's out of here. So he's looking, he may be dead wrong, but he believes he's right, and he's going to finish the job. So
I don't know what finish the job even means. I'm not sure he does. I read the White House website, report or whatever his plan for his strategy plan. Can you explain to me what it means? There's no time. I mean, forget. I'm not talking about specific time dates. What's the timetable? What's the long term thing? They asked McCain the other day the same question on Face the Nation or Meet the Press, and he couldn't explain it either.
Well, you know, we can attack those point by point. From what I understand, there's a 3-point strategy. So he's addressed two of them already, and I guess next week will be the last one. And of course, it'll be timely because it'll be he'll probably give it on the 13th or 14th, and the Iraqi elections on the 15th. I have the CNN speech up on, or the speech up on CNN, so I can refer to it if I have to. But okay, let's start with the last piece and then move backwards. The last piece is the political piece, and that is the general idea of democratizing Iraq and how it will produce long-term peace, which I believe that the only way to finally take the steam out of these suicide bombers and so on is to give them something to do, give them a job, and also give them a voice short of blowing themselves up. So let them duke it out, just like we do. We have arguments in, you know, Congress and the state senates and so on, that we should allow that to happen in Iraq, and that'll take some of the steam out of the violence. If you're allowed to shout it out, primal scream therapy, whatever, you know, that will reduce terrorism. So I believe that. So, you know, what do you think about the political process in Iraq, and how is it going, and whether it's a good plan or not?
Well, again, I'm skeptical about the definition of Mr. Bush's terms for democracy and right out of the gate, because I mean, this is again, I don't want to use the word laughable, but I'm appalled at what is passing for democracy and what I think is the official. I'm probably going to paraphrase this wrongly, but I think the official name that they've given in their constitution for their country is the Islamic Revolutionary Republic of Iraq. Is that the democracy we're talking about, the one where women are going to be far less able to express themselves, especially at a local level than they were under Saddam Hussein? That's the democracy we're talking about? That's what he's building. His building block is, and Smith Rice, Dr. Rice and the rest of the people speaking about freedom being on the march ignore ad nauseum, Mark, the fact that not only are we less free since this process, since Iraq and since this war on terror, but the Iraqis are going to be no more free. It's great. The Russians voted too. They have elections in China. It doesn't make them a democracy. I mean, this is if you read chapter and verse of the Constitution and the it starts out by saying that basically the Islamic law is going to always be deferred to if there's ever a question about whether it'll be sort of the rule of law or the rule of Islamic law, the Sharia law. The Sharia law is going to always take precedence. So that alone, to me, completely contradicts anything about there being a democracy in any real form or fashion in Iraq at all. And that's why we have 150,000 American troops and all these administrators on the ground. Wait till they're gone. What are they going to do then? I mean, I dismiss the fact that there's democracy, real democracy happening there at all. And my side point to that, Mark, would be, I also find it equally laughable that they talk that that's our policy. Are we going to knock out the Saudis next? When you talk about kings, there's one right next door. Are they going to go after the other Islamic regimes that apply these laws like that? What about Iran? I mean, if that's their strategy, they haven't said it. Are they going to go after the Syrians next? I mean, so I don't believe that's our policy. I don't believe that democracy is really happening in Iraq in any real way, except as a sort of a circus.
Okay. Let me comment a few of those. I am trying to get the Constitution of Iraq, and I'm sure I'll have it. I got one from March 2004, but I'm sure I'll get it on Google here in a second. In any case, a couple of comments. First off, every democracy has to have a local face. So there will be some things that seem bizarre to Americans and British and Canadians, and that's understandable. Turkey has a democracy, and it has a local face on it, has an Islamic face. So there's going to be things that are going to be a little weird. Will it be exactly the same as ours? Absolutely not. Will women have exactly the same amount of rights? Probably not. However, we have to look at it as a work in progress. So a couple of things that give me hope. First off, I don't know whether to follow through on it or not, but the Shias have promised that they will reopen the Constitution discussion once the election takes place, once the Sunnis have more people in the assembly, closer to what their percentage of the overall population is, then they'll reopen it. And if I remember correctly, they were going to have another vote on the Constitution, have a new Constitution and vote on it again. So it's a work in progress. Now, if you look at our own history, and I know about there's a problem with fighting the last war, so we have to be careful about taking lessons from history. But if we look at our own history, we started out with the Articles of Confederation, and then we had a Constitution, and then we immediately had 10 amendments. So there is an amendment process, and it'll continue. In our own country, we remember it is probably true that Iraqi women won't have as many rights as they should have, but in our own country, women couldn't vote until the early 20th century. And furthermore, you know, Black Americans, of course, were completely shut out. Enslaved. So it's a work in progress. You have to start somewhere. Is it perfect? Absolutely not. But if you create a vision, and just like our American forefathers did, they created a vision. It took a long time to work into it. You know, when they drafted the Constitution, there was slavery, there was women were disenfranchised, but we've worked into it. They're going through the same thing.
Well, I mean, I don't mean to laugh. Are you really comparing 225 years ago to the democracy and what we define as democracy then to now, Mark? I mean, that seems to be this. I've heard this talking point from the Republicans for, 6 months now. Well, we had to fight a civil war. We had slavery. Yeah, we did 225 years ago. Have we not been informed since then what democracy can be and should be in a modern context? Because that's what he seems to want to tell us that he's going to do in Iraq, Mr. Bush. Except the reality is he's not. And then when people bring that to him, and I'm not talking just about Americans, I'm human rights people, the European Union, et cetera, and say this is not a real democracy and you're actually going backwards in many cases, not forwards, backwards from Hussein, the answer is, well, we weren't perfect either. Well, so what? You know, to say that, that what's, is that the standard, slavery and and the disenfranchisement of women as voters. I mean, okay, that's what it was. We know what it should be. Why are we not applying what it should be now and going forward from there, Mark?
Well, certainly the current Iraqi constitution falls short of standards such as Canada and Australia and the U.S., but it's a big leap forward from Egypt and Jordan, some places. So I think you have to look at it.
Mark, can I just? You're obviously a very well-informed historical guy. That's like MacArthur or whoever that sort of sat down with the Japanese after, to use the same kind of thinking of applying history to this, which is like saying our constitution was this when it was. And when they sat down with the Japanese, they didn't say, "You can have something that's, you know, sort of whatever you like as long as it's better than it, you know, was before you were invaded the rest of the world." I mean, they said, "This is what you're going to do." Period. And this is the bottom line. I don't understand. I mean, on one hand, I hear from you guys on the right and Mr. Bush, we're going to stay there and finish the job. It's like this business of until we win the war. Then second, it's what there never is going to be a signing on a battleship. Then third, when it comes to this issue, it's, well, we can't really expect them to do X, Y, and Z. Why can't we? Is it a war or isn't it? If it's a real war, then we can dictate the constitutional terms of that country and say, here's how you're going to do it. And until you do this, we're not going to leave. I mean, that's never been talked about. That's never been applied. And it's a huge cop-out to, on the one hand, say militarily we're going to stay the course and hang in till the end. And then and when it comes to the democracy side, say, well, that's the hard part. And if we actually demanded real democracy, that wouldn't work. So we can't do that. That's the two sides of this that I don't understand in terms of how the right presents this.
Well,
either we really are going to have a democracy that's going to do what you say it's going to do, Mark, which is provide freedom and foster democracies around it, or we're going to have a fake democracy that takes another 50 years or 100 years to even start to happen, and very likely that democracy that's not a real one gets crushed by things like the giant armies next door to it who are not democracies. So I don't buy that.
Okay, well, there's no guarantee that the current constitution does not reach those. I'm going to go ahead and read from the preamble. I hope this is the right draft constitution, but I'll just use it as a talking point.
Okay.
We the people of Iraq, newly arisen. I got to change my mic here so I can read this. We the people of Iraq, newly arisen from our disaster and looking with confidence to the future through a democratic federal republican system, are determined, men and women, old and young, to respect the rule of law. Okay, sounds pretty good. Reject the policy of aggression. Pay attention to women and their rights. All right, that is a little weak. You know, pay attention to women and their rights.
I got to pay attention to them, Mark.
The elderly and their care,
America.
The children and their affairs, and spread the culture of diversity and diffuse terrorism. And then it goes on. You know,
I also like the word diffuse in a preamble. That's very adamant, isn't it? We're going to diffuse it. Why not destroy it? Why not eliminate it?
Well, you know, it's Jay, it just depends your look at it. Is the glass half empty or half full? So I see it, you know, I see this as a big step forward if you compare to, say, the emir of all the Emirites and so on in that area. I see it as a big step forward. Does it reach the level of Canada and Australia?
I agree with you. It's better than slavery. You're right. It's better than slavery. But it's not democracy.
Well, you know, there are provisions for that. So let's agree to disagree on the political point. Let's look at let's go back to the first discussion, and that was the military strategy. So from the best that I can gather, we're going to continue to to seek out terrorists and crush them, and also build up the local military, and hopefully at some point turn the keys over to them. So that's really basic, but tell me, how do you think the military strategy is? How is it going? And what would you do to change it?
Well, I mean, my number one thing, and I'm taking a, I won't base it all on this, it's certainly not, but, you know, as Wesley Clark and two guys as far apart, although probably both candidates for president, Wesley Clark and John McCain said this recently this weekend, what is the strategy? I don't think the troops know, and I don't think we know. There isn't a strategy. And, in fact, John Murtha, this is a guy who is a, you know, And Mark, I know you're a military guy. Who's going to be the next guy that this administration smears? Another decorated veteran who they're going to smear has said is basically the strategy is walk out on the street till you get shot. I mean, we don't have enough troops to hold any particular areas in this country. And the military strategy across the board of defeating the insurgency, I mean, you could make a comedy track, Mark, of the statements. It's like William Westmoreland's statements from Vietnam. of the commanders in the ground, and I've heard many of them, and I've seen many of them, where they start off, you know, 2 years ago saying there will be no more resistance. The resistance is in its last throes, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, I mean, this is a completely mismanaged. I don't see any real progress. We lost 10 soldiers the other day, didn't we? That's one of the biggest Marine losses in the entire history of the war. Almost every time I hear that the casualties are going down, they go back up, et cetera. So I don't know what coherent strategy is being applied. And when you break down the numbers of the broader strategy, I guess, of training the Iraqi troops, look at the actual active duty and trained Iraqi battalions who operate only on their own, and there's almost none. And that's in how long we've been there? 2.5 years? So I don't know what strategy there is right now.
All right. Well, I agree with you on many points. I have a friend who's a major in the Pentagon, and he's really frustrated. He spent 5 months in Iraq, and he's really frustrated. He blames it not on the political administration, but he blames it on the military and how officers are trained to take orders. Officers and enlisted men are trained to take orders, and they're not trained to think out of the box. And they are fighting the last war. And they're not capable of being creative and coming up with something new, because people like that, people who are creative, are drummed out of the services, and they end up, you know, starting Apple Computer or something.
Right.
So it is a military problem.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, you go.
I mean, this is one of those things I have heard bandied about, and I think it is kind of a. I don't know historically if it's accurate. I wonder if you know, but I think it's germane to this issue. Have you ever, do you know of an occupying force that's defeated an insurgency? And I'm not loading that question. I really wonder if there is one. I've heard people discuss this.
I'm going to have to put on my thinking cap about that.
I mean, certainly in this century, that's not a good track record. I got to say that. And it's not just us. I mean, even the Brits. I mean, I suppose the, I don't know. Over the long haul, I don't know what local insurgencies have ever been defeated by.
Yes, actually, I can think of one, and that is shortly after the Spanish-American War, America took custody of the Philippines, and then I can't remember the number of years, but it was a long guerrilla warfare against Philippine insurgents. It was brutal. Good thing there wasn't 24-hour news coverage back then, because, regular people would have been disgusted at what our military was doing. But, yes, in a brutal manner, we crushed the Philippine insurgency. It was from, I believe, about 1900 to 1907 or whereabouts.
I'm going to go ahead and
Google that. But
well, then you may very well be right. But in terms of the big picture, honestly, I don't know about any long struggle. I don't believe that 2,000 soldiers died. I'll tell you that. I could be wrong, but I mean,
explain the statement.
Against that insurgency, I'd be doubtful. But the broader issue to me is. You know, you talk about Vietnam and Ho Chi Minh, or if they're quoting them, whatever. The unfortunate reality is, and the same thing as many insurgents over the centuries, I suppose, they aren't going anywhere. And in this whole business of, like, if we tell them we're leaving, then they'll just wait. Well, they're going to wait anyway. I mean, I don't know what fantasy world Mr. Bush lives in, that he just thinks that they aren't in many ways exactly like the Vietnamese, and that's why I believe they created some of the exact same problems as Vietnam. And by that, I mean that Ho Chi Minh says we'll be here for a million years. And they would have been. I mean, they had been occupied for literally 10 centuries on and off. And they didn't care who it was. They were going to eventually, you know, those people were insurgents for centuries on and off. I think it's the same thing you have in this country right now in Iraq. I think we're kidding ourselves that we're going to be tougher than they are. And we're going to defeat this business. We're going to hold it longer than theirs. So that was the broader issues. I don't know when there has been a situation where an occupying army was really over a long period just defeated an insurgency. So,
well, you know, both sides, both the left and the right, use history to support their point. So I've done it with the American Revolution and the Civil War, and you just did it with Vietnam. I'll go ahead and comment on this. I get this information from, I will not mention his name because it could jeopardize his career, but my friend, a major in the Pentagon, and he says there's a couple key differences between this conflict and the Vietnam conflict. First off, there's no organized and steady and strong supply system. So, you know, eventually they're going to run out of money. There's not a Russia or a China or something like that, although some people would say that it's Iran, and that could be the case. Unfortunately, we haven't been able to prove that quite yet. But so that talking point may be dead wrong, and maybe Iran or Syria that's supplying. But as far as we know right now, there's no supplier vis-a-vis Russia. Okay, second point is that it seems to be that the general Iraqi population, by and large, does not support the terrorists. And, of course, the terrorists have themselves to blame for that because, as another letter which was intercepted, which may or may not be true, that one al-Qaeda guy was saying to another al-Qaeda guy that if you continue to do this, can you blow up regular Iraqis, you're going to turn them against them. Now, everything I've read says that that by and large, the general Iraqi population is against terrorism, and it's in the Constitution here, the last line, defuse terrorism, and of course they voted it in. So I would say those two key points are the differences.
Okay, actually, I'm glad you referred back to that because I managed to find this as well. If I could just pull it up here somewhere. And are you looking at that Constitution?
Yeah, I don't know if I've got the same one or the right one. There's so much on the internet.
I've got this as a link through the NPR website, so I'm going to go ahead and say they probably have this correct. Article 7: Islam is the official religion of the state. It is to be considered a source of legislation. No law that contradicts the universally agreed tenets of Islam or the rights cited in Chapter 2 of this law may be enacted during this transitional period. The law respects the Islamic identity of the majority of Iraqi people, guarantees full religious rights of all individuals to freedom, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, I mean, there you go, Mark. It's Article 7. I mean, that's that. And when you get into the principles of Islamic law, I don't need to tell you or anybody else that's as smart as you are what they are. And many of those things are, you know, that go on in Pakistan, which is considered to be a quote-unquote enlightened or more modernized Islamic state, I think, and that's, you know, fathers throwing acid on their daughters' faces and not being prosecuted because their daughters committed adultery or broke a marriage vow, women being beaten by local police, which is going on in Iraq right now on the local level, et cetera, et cetera, and nothing's being done. And this is the law that this is what you're talking about being democracy. That's laughable.
Well, you know, first off, you're making an assumption. You're making an assumption that Islam has to be that way, has to be tyrannical. And I don't necessarily buy that. There's different ways to interpret Islam,
there are many parts of
the Quran.
Events that are happening on the ground right now, and you're saying that I shouldn't be worried about that.
Well, of course, we should all be worried about tyranny. We need to keep an eye out. But I'm not saying this is your argument, but I don't buy the argument that I've heard before that Islam is incompatible with democracy and vice versa. I mean, right now, certainly there's problems, but you can look at Turkey and say it's a reasonably functioning democracy with reasonable rights. I believe they had a female prime minister recently in the last 10 years or so. And I don't know how long she lasted. She probably got, you know, shuffled out, but at least she had her shot. And I believe also Pakistan has had a woman prime minister, and that's an Islamic state. That didn't last too long. And, of course, India has had many women.
I believe they were knocked out by a coup, and now they have a military dictator basically called President Musharraf.
That's not good. That
actually, in its own way, Mark, completely contradicts your whole point. The military came back and took over, and as much, if it weren't for us propping this, I mean, this is pure, I shouldn't say pure opinion. I think there's a lot of evidence to back this up. If we weren't backing, I believe if we were not backing Musharraf at this incredible level, he would barely be hanging on. And the minute we don't need him anymore, forget it. They're going to eat him alive. I mean, you look at the report that the 9/11 Commission guys issued the other day about things that really I think are germane to this issue, and that's one of those is our ability and our demands that these madrasas and some of the most virulent madrasas, and I believe we've got to make strides to try to engage in this issue, being closed, they got an F. We're not doing anything about that. I mean, none of the rest of the so we moved our troops in, and we're going to put this so-called constitution democracy in there while these madrasas around that region flourish like never before. They're full. They're packed.
Well, you see, that's part of the plan. I mean, part of the plan in Iraq is to westernize it so that we can put an end to these schools of hate.
But there were no madrasas like that there before. Mark Hussein wasn't allowing it. There were none. There's going to be plenty of madrasas now, and I bet you there's a whole bunch of them now because they're free to do it under your definition of democracy coexisting with Islam.
You're ignoring
the fact that one of the most radical Islamic forces in the whole Middle East is one's on one side of them, one's on the other.
Okay, that's
crazy.
Let's take a little break. You're tuned to KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. You're on the web at KUCI.org. You are on iTunes, Public Radio, and KUCI. You're also on the air in Orange County at 88.9 FM, hitting most of Orange County. So welcome, listeners. I'm not taking callers because I do not have a screener. But if you have some, well, you're going to have to stew in your car. Sorry about that, guys. I do not have a screener. Okay, the views expressed in the show are not the views of KUCI, the University of California, the Regents, the Governate, or any elected official custodies the taxes that fund this university and the whole system. Actually, our license is not just for UCI; it's for the whole UC system. So, the station for Berkeley, Pomona, and all that is all covered under this.
They're loving me in Berkeley, Mark.
And Santa Barbara, and so on. Okay, let me kind of address that point. I want to hone in on. I want to go back to the point of Islam and democracy. Are they compatible? And I know these madrasas are part of the problem, and we have to address that. These madrasas are schools of hate. They teach children to hate. Now, I think it's cynical, and I know you're not saying this, but some people in you describe yourself as a Hollywood liberal or something like that?
Well, no, I think that's what I was making a joke. I don't know that clearly I'm very liberal on a lot of these political issues, and I'm very, I think I would surprise you how middle of the road or right wing on other issues as well. So, but that would be my broad characterization, yes.
Some people on the left have said, have made two statements that I think are cynical. And one is that I've addressed this, Islam is incompatible with democracy. I don't buy it. I think Turkey is a good example. And two, the other one is that, oh my God, I've forgotten my other point. But I'll remember in a second. Let's go back to the Islam. You mentioned a bunch of backsliding in Pakistan. They had democracy. They do. They don't. Yesterday they had it. Tomorrow they don't. That has nothing to do with Islam. I mean, you can look at Christian countries. You can look all over South America, and there's lots of backsliding. I mean, Argentina has been a model democracy, and then they went back and forth, and then they had the, in the 70s where they killed a bunch of people. So it has nothing to do with Islam. That just has to do with human nature, okay?
It has largely to do with Americans backing dictators there, Mark, and that's another example of another hypocrisy I think the far right in this country, not the far right, the right in this country, which is that we back who we like to back. And I agree with you on the main point. The main point we are in accord on. I think there are democracy can sort of coexist with Islam. There's no question in my mind about that. I don't think that there's something about the principles of Islam when applied the right way any more than the Bible. You could look at the Bible and say you couldn't have a democracy based on some of the tenets of the Bible. I think that they can coexist. In this particular case, though, and that's where I think that's where I'm taking issue with where you're coming from. In this particular case, you can't ignore the what's happening on the ground right now, including what's happened since Hussein has left. And I point to the things like the fact that in local communities right now, religious police have resurfaced, the kind of religious police they have in Saudi Arabia and in Iran that didn't exist before and are reapplying these rules. And I got to say, in terms of Pakistan, just quickly cutting back there for a second, Pakistan, where does everybody, including if you ask them, the CIA think Osama bin Laden is hiding? Most of them think he's somewhere on the border of Afghanistan and Pakistan. So, I mean, to say that that's somehow even a functioning democracy to me is crazy when, in fact, those people are so pro radical Islam, that they're hiding out the biggest tyrant in the world in their own country. And yet we supposedly are bringing democracy to Afghanistan, and Pakistan's a functioning democracy, yet Osama bin Laden, we probably would, at least if the CIA estimates are, that's where he's staying. That's where he's hiding out. These people are harboring him. That's supposedly making progress towards democracy. I just think my point is that it doesn't matter if they can coexist. Right now, the realities of what's happening on the ground do not back that up. It's not getting better for those people in all over that region. And I think it's a bit of a – is it possible? Sure. I think it's a fantasy to think that that's happening when you look at the facts that are happening on the ground right now.
Okay. Certainly, there are very few perfect situations, but I think it just depends on how you look at it. There is some backsliding in Afghanistan, but there's also been a lot of progress as well. But let me go back to the point, the cynical point number two that I just remembered, and that is that somehow the point that things were better, that we should have just left Saddam Hussein alone, we would have been better off. If he was still in power. And I find that very cynical, because if you look at this guy's track record and all the bad things he's done to his people and other countries around him, his neighboring countries, I just find it very cynical to say that we should have left him in power. I mean, this was a bad guy. I mean, we had some stuff wrong. We had some intelligence wrong. But, you know, it was the right thing to take this monster out. And,
really?
And I believe it was the right thing, you know, because the thing is, you also, I don't know if
you're... When did you get mad at him, Mark? Were you mad at him in 85? Was calling for this before the elections? Were you saying our policy should be to take out this evil tyrant with his rape rooms and his torture chambers?
Yes.
In
the 90s, I was annoyed of the weak response of Clinton. And remember, Mr. Clinton... also was many statements have said we got to take this guy out and he's a bad guy in so many words, but I was annoyed at Mr. Clinton's tepid response to World Trade Center 1, to the Cole, the USS Cole, and
right.
to the twin embassies. I mean,
the Republicans supported Clinton when he went to Kosovo, right? Things like that. When he used military for humanitarian benefits, the Republicans supported him. Is that basically your position?
I don't want to get off subject there, but
never said he doesn't have the moral authority to lead troops. He didn't say that. He did say that.
You got me on that one.
The head of the Senate, or the majority leader at the time, said that Mr. Clinton, when he went into Kosovo, didn't have the moral authority to lead, and yet we, the same Republicans now, are telling us, you know, you leave politics at the water's edge. That when he fired those missiles into Somalia, they said he was wagging the dog and it was Monica Gate. When he shot missiles into Pakistan, all those cruise missiles to try to kill him in that camp, which is what we all know is the reality now. In fact, that's not disputed anymore because the intelligence has been revealed. What do the Republicans say, by and large, not just the pundits, Mark, across the board, they said he's wagging the dog, he's trying to take our eye off the ball of Monica. I mean, so, and now it's completely reversed. And actually, getting back to the main point, because you kind of went to Clinton, which is I love that. It's like everything's Clinton's fault at this point.
No, it's not his fault, but he also supported the same principle.
That the policies of Mr. Hussein, of Saddam Hussein, were so egregious that we should attack them. When? Because in 2000, Mark, he said we shouldn't be nation building. In 2000, Colin Powell and Condoleezza Rice, after the election, said that he poses no threat. We have him totally contained. We've eliminated his ability to make war on his neighbors. So when did this policy, if he's such a bad tyrant, he needs to be destroyed by the U.S. military at a cost of 15,000 wounded and 2,000 dead soldiers and $250 billion in debt? When did he make that decision?
It would have been after September 11th, 2001.
So that's when those crimes became so heinous we had to invade him, but not before.
Well, you know, what it did is it changed the picture. So it altered the picture. You know, I mean, consistency is a good thing in many cases, but also, you know, world events do change things. So people change their view over time.
But you've just changed your reason for the war. Before the war, what was his reasoning? That they had weapons of mass destruction, that we were going to have a nuclear cloud if we didn't go after him. It wasn't human rights violations, Mark.
The administration had a laundry list of things, and I did a number. I had a talk show at the time on the station, and I did a number of shows, and I went through, you know, I went through a laundry list, and any number of those reasons would have been a good reason. It's just they changed the emphasis, so they would lead with one thing and lead to another. But all the other things were still there. They were at the end of the speech. But
I will happily do right now. I'm sure I can Google it in 2 seconds. I'll pull up his first Bush's speeches. His stump speech from 2000. You're telling me that there's rape rooms and human rights violations, and we should take out his plan?
It was toward the end, but yes, yeah, I can. I mean, I can't quote word for word,
then
but when I remember at the time,
Colin Powell and Condoleezza Rice, after they were elected, saying that they were no threat to us.
Because
why would that be if what you're saying is true? Because they absolutely did say that.
Because at the time that was the case, but after the terrorist attacks, it just became more apparent we have to be more vigilant. I mean, they thought before September 11th, they thought we could leave him alone. But after that, they realized that this is worse than I thought.
And that was all wrong.
But
that was true.
I don't know if they're you know, you have to look at a decision and a statement based in the context of the time. So
what do you make of the quote after 9/11 that I've heard, thank God, played hundreds of times on both right and left wing radio stations, and certainly on every blog in the universe, when Bush said, quote, "We have no evidence to suggest there's a link between 9/11 and Saddam Hussein." What do you make of that?
I think he's right, but you see, there's you know, for me, I look at the broader picture that for me, it was reason enough to take out Hussein to start a long-term process to get at the long-term roots of Islamic terrorism. And the first step is to take the opportunity that you had, and I know Iran, we should get there eventually, and I know Syria is a big problem, but the opportunity they had was to start with Iraq and to start the process of democratizing Middle East, because that's the long term. You know, there's a difference between solving a problem with the Band-Aid in the short term and looking at the long term. And the one thing I laud this officials, and also Bill Maher says the same thing on HBO, that is that at least this guy, this Bush guy, is thinking long term. I don't have the confidence in Mr. Kerry, and that's one of the reasons why I didn't vote for him. I didn't have the confidence in Mr. Kerry would look at the long term solution, that he would just slap a Band-Aid on it and stop. At least this Bush guy is looking 30, 50, 100, 150, 200 years out saying that the way to stop the long-term Islamic terrorism is to start to democratize, to get into countries so we can shut down these schools of hate and so on.
Which we're not doing.
And that's reason enough.
And you're going back to the talking points, Mark. The fact is you just changed your story entirely, and this is exactly why his opinion polls on this war, even on his base, have eroded to an unbelievable level. Why he's on his new Karl Rove-invented campaign to reinvent himself and reinvent his reasons for war, he's doing the same thing you're doing. You just finished doing exactly what they've done for 2 years now. They can't figure it out. Before the war, it was military, and that's the absolute truth. Before the war, it was military. We had to attack this guy. He had these weapons of mass destruction and mobile laboratories, and they literally made Colin Powell into their puppet and go in there with a bag of whatever he went in there with and say it was anthrax when it wasn't. And then after the war, and this is the rebuilding of this whole premise to go, it's because he was a bad guy and he murdered his own civilians.
It's a question of emphasis. You know, I saw all those reasons before the war, and I did several shows before they attacked.
You may have, but I'm talking about the president, Mark. I'm not talking about you.
I saw all those reasons, and any one of seven or eight reasons would have been reason enough. It's just a question of emphasis. It's a question of what you lead with.
Yeah, but he was leading with the fact that we had to go to war to protect this nation from being attacked, Mark. That's what he based it on. That was the priority. Dick Cheney sat on television, and you know, we crucified the last president for lying about an affair that had no impact on national security at all. And Dick Cheney sat on television and said, "We know he has weapons of mass destruction with an absolute certainty." Donald Rumsfeld sat on television after the invasion and said, "We know he has these weapons. We know where they are. They're in and around Tikrit." Those are lies. Lies that have cost thousands of soldiers their lives and 10,000 more their limbs and their eyes and everything else, and that was based on a military rationale. And after that turned out to be completely false, it turned to, well, Saddam Hussein was a bad tyrant. No worse than the people in Rwanda. No worse than the people in Darfur. No worse than the people in North Korea or Iran or any of the other dictators we backed and still back, including Pakistan, across the board. So this is what I'm saying. You want it both ways.
Jay, it was
a military threat. We believe that. And then when that turned out to be false, which it was completely false, and I believe manipulated, but we can argue that till the cows come home, and I'm sure that will happen for 50 years. Then it became he's a bad guy. Unfortunately, the big hole in that rationale, Mark, is that he wasn't a bad guy when he gassed those Kurds, and Donald Rumsfeld went there the next week and patted him on the back. And Ronald Reagan took him off after he gassed those Kurds. Ronald Reagan took him off the terrorist nations list. Why? For one reason, we could sell him helicopters and everything else. And at that point, he was a good guy. He was okay with us. So you can have it one way or the other, but don't give me this moral crisis thing about we have to go protect this guy, the Iraqi people, from a tyrant when, in fact, for the 15 years before, no Republican said boo about it, and neither did George Bush. The guy sat in the debates and said, we shouldn't be nation-building. He didn't want to go to Kosovo. He criticized the Clinton administration for doing that. They criticized him for shooting missiles into Afghanistan and et cetera over Monica Gate. So you can have it one way or the other. You can't have it both.
I've got 5 minutes left. You're tuned to KUCI 80.9 FM in Irvine. Jay, go ahead and reintroduce yourself and tell us what you're working on and what projects you're working on, and then we'll lead out with I'll give each of us 2.5 minutes.
All right. I'm Jay Leggett. I'm a writer and an actor and screenwriter and actor in Hollywood. I just started as on a comedy show called In Living Color, more than 10 years ago now, as an actor, and I've been directing and writing stuff in Hollywood since, a lot of TV stuff, and recently my last two films were Employee of the Month, available in your local Blockbuster, as is my other, I guess, most recent movie, which is Without a Paddle, a big, silly comedy that came out last summer. And I'm working on two new things, a pilot, which is for Spike TV, called Factory, about four blue-collar guys that my partner, business partner Mitch Rouse, wrote and is going to direct, and a feature film for Fox, which is we're just finishing up right now. So,
okay, today we spent the last hour talking about obviously a hot subject, the war in Iraq. I'm going to give a short 1 minute or less
point. Hey, can I take 15 seconds just to give you some props here?
Okay, go ahead.
I got to say, probably as adamant on some of the stuff as I sound, I got to say you're one of the guys, and there's plenty of people like you. I wish there were more, two-sided and bigger-thinking people on the right than like yourself, because I really do think you make a lot of good points. I feel like that some of the people who support the president more than I do clearly their voices don't get through and have to the balance that I think they need up there, and I think you're doing a good job of bringing those points out.
I appreciate it, and I'd like to give props to you for coming on. You've been a great guest. I'll give you the final word. I also want to give props to community radio that this what we're doing here, KUCI. We are non-commercial. We're all volunteers. We have one full-time employee, and this is part of democracy that we can't be bought. There's no commercials.
That's great.
The funding has no strings. So as long as we don't say one of the seven deadly words,
right,
we can pretty much get away with anything. Okay, I'll make a quick point. I supported the war in Iraq before it started, and I support it now. I think we need to finish it. I think there are three good reasons for doing it, and then I'll stop. Number one is we cannot fail, because if we fail, it'll open the door for every bad guy in the world to attack us because we think we're weak. Right now, there are already tons of terrorists and bad people are already citing Vietnam and other failures where we backed out. We need to do this like the Philippines in the early 19th century. We need to finish the job. It can be done. Secondly, this is a long-term strategy. What a lot of people can't seem to understand, and as dim-witted as he may seem, either he or his people, Mr. Bush has a long-term strategy, and Mr. Bill Maher also cites this, that they're trying to get at the roots of Islamic terrorism. They're doing it by democracy. Is it perfect? No. Is it a start? Yes. There is a democracy, and they have election coming up next week. And actually, I'll stop at 2. Final word. You got till 10 o'clock.
Okay, final word. I think we are there, and I think to pull out completely right now, like anybody else, I hope any rational person, I don't think we can do that right away, but I don't think we're accomplishing anything there. I don't see a strategy. We were taken into this war based on one premise, and now it's become something else. Secondly, I think that the truth is that I don't believe they're looking long-term. In fact, they're ignoring the possible long-term consequences, which to me and to many people I think are obvious, and that is that we're destabilizing a country that will very likely split into three countries and then come under the influence of people like Iran, who is a bigger threat, and we've ignored them in this obsession that Mr. Bush has with occupying and invading Iraq. Secondly, I think that the every time I turn the television on and see another kid that's been killed, another kid that's had his leg blown off, for what I believe in 10 years we'll look back and say was nothing more significant than Vietnam, it kills me. And I think that for the sake of those people, this president has to rethink the strategy, withdraw these troops in some kind of time and manner, and realize that he's blundered us into what I think will be looked back on as something that is a miniature version of Vietnam, a very ill-thought-out strategy with no exit strategy to begin with. And I think I'm on the opposite side. I think the long-term view of this entire operation will be one that does not bear out what you're talking about. I think Mr. Bush is going to be looked at as someone who made a gigantic mistake and didn't make things better. In fact, very likely will have made things worse, if anything.
Okay, Mr. J. Leggett, we can't name a price because that's against public radio, but what's the next thing that the people can buy that you've been involved with?
Well, for Christmas right now, I think there's a new Without a Paddlist, the film of the DVD is out and is selling very well, I'm happy to report. So that's probably the latest thing that's in the stores right now.
Okay, you can't name a price or a place, but
you've been tuned. I think I may have done it before, Mark. You may have to edit me out of that.
You've been tuned to KUCI, University of California, Irvine, and the Regents University of California. The views expressed to show are not the views of any of those two or the governor or any elected official of the state of California. Mr. Leggett, you've been great, and I appreciate it.
Mark, you're the best. Anytime.
Take care. I will. I recorded this, and I will pod it, and I will proliferate it around the web, and I'll keep everybody in the college community, radio community, informed where they can get it on the web.
All righty.
Okay. Take care.
Thank you. Bye.
All right. Bye bye. Okay. This has been Heart to Heart Talk. You've been tuned to KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine.